If you want my loving, all you got to do is subscribe on, just subscribe on the podcasting platform that you are. It really is helpful for me. I know it's annoying when people ask, but I'm just trying to get a little bit of traction on this. So a comment or a like or a subscribe or a rating is very helpful. Thank you. Also go to johnsavage.com and sign up at the newsletter if you want. No pressure, but there's some little things we're cooking up back here. Some cool little merchy ideas. And nice things for you. So check out, and they're going to be super limited edition, small ranges, because we're literally going to hand make them. I don't want to tell you what it is yet, but it's coming. So just subscribe, johnsavage.com/whatsyourpoison for that. Also, don't forget our lovely partners at Whiskey Brother. Order the whiskey from them because it makes us feel nice and them feel nice and makes us continue doing all these lovely things. All right, enough of me. Let's do this. It's hard to explain how honored I feel doing this show. I feel really fortunate to be sitting in this seat. And every week I get to meet really incredible people and learn a lot. And hopefully you get to learn something. So I know that the sort of general vibe is let's just drink and talk shit. And that is the vibe. But when you meet someone of substance, you know, you just don't know where the conversation is going to go and what value someone like this can bring to your life. Now, Burita. Burita is just, okay, from a talent perspective, undeniable, so soulful. And what attracted me to Burita is the, I mean, if you know my show by now, I have so much love and an obsession with our legacy artists and our great African stars who sort of, you know, they pass away a lot these days. COVID, pre-COVID and onwards, you know, they're not getting any younger. But if you ever met some of these guys, you just can't believe the energy, the knowledge. And that's a lot of the work that I'm involved in, is trying to bring that stuff out of our greats. And even this podcast is a guy's, I mean, it's a trick. You may or may not have noticed, interviewing really cool people, but then really putting in those legacy artists who I really want more people to sort of get to know better in this space. And that was my long way of saying what was beautiful about Burita is a kindred spirit of someone who really, really is in touch with where the music comes from, her heritage. And there's some great stories here about Oliver Mtukudzi, because obviously Burita is from Zimbabwe, so is Oliver, and her meeting Hugh and Oliver together and being the only artist in the country who has both of them on a track. But more than that, you know, yes, she does soul music, but her soul is in not just her music, in everything she does. She has an unbelievable come up story. She's so smart. You will learn, you know, what I loved was how open she was about the mistakes that she made, about signing a 360 deal early on in her career. We speak about Zimbabwe and the history of Zimbabwe, which I don't know a lot. So I was kind of pressing to see where she'd go. And we talk a lot about where she comes from, about the music that inspired her, but really about the music business. Her approach to the music business is so refreshing and so straight. You know you're dealing with a megastar. Her husband is Nota, who is another legend in the music industry from the business perspective. So we talk about him as well. It's a very interesting and incredible, and I think part one of a great conversation with someone who is a true great in the making. So she doesn't drink. That's on her. I'm not taking responsibility for that. that's not an owner. That's just of the nature of the show. That's why I was saying that. If you're new to the show, that wasn't an indictment on anyone. The nature of the show is just whatever your poison is, whether it's chocolate, coffee, whiskey, weed. You know, we discuss vices and we try to partake in them in this show. And that's the self-indulgent part. It didn't really happen on this one, but don't worry about it. We've got a wicked, wicked interview with the incredible Burita on What's Your Poison?
Okay. Yes.
Hello. And
hi.
Lovely to I think I've met you once before. Haven't I met you on the stairs at Amped once?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I was, I'm usually very stressed when I'm doing projects at that space. So I'm not usually not very friendly, but I think I saw you there once.
I think you were very friendly to me, actually.
Oh, good. Sure, just in case.
No, I think we had like just a brief conversation, but it was, you know, it was a friendly one.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yeah.
Well, lovely to actually be chatting to you. Really appreciate you being on. This is quite weird for me. It's the first time I've ever done a day one of these.
Yeah, and at some point we were trying to fake it, right? We were trying to say, hey, let's make it dark. Let's.
No. But, you know, usually, so what normally happens on this show is I drink whiskey regardless of the other person. But I did think it's still early in the day. It's not the best idea. So I do. This is my other poison, right? I flakies. That's what I. That's
I used
I like.
To love those when I was younger.
When I go to the engine around the corner, I'm even if I'm going to buy milk, I don't tell anyone. Little flaky, eat it on the way home. No one knows.
You know what? My current poison. You know, in that likeness, I can't get over Magnum. Like, ooh, it just helped me so much. Like,
which one?
Well, the classic is really good for me, but like on extra stressful days, I'll have
almond.
The death by chocolate.
Oh, wow! That one's hectic.
That one is hectic. That one is.
Be
hectic,
honest with me, all right? Mm-hmm. How many would do you have? One a day, one a week.
So I can't. Tell you what, John. I just got off holiday, and while I was on holiday, I was basically, you know, just indulging. So I came back, and I was like, I have to, you know, ease a little bit on the sugar. So I haven't actually. I've only had it once because when my husband picked me up from the airport, he was carrying a Magnum. I was like, no. I just.
So are you detoxing? You know, are you in Magnum detox?
Yeah, I'm on Magnum detox at the moment.
And then what are your other, just to start here and get it out the way, what are your other vices? Do you smoke? Do you, what are the things that are bad for you that you?
What are the things that are bad for me? I don't drink, which I don't think drinking is bad. I just don't come from a family where we consume alcohol. So never really consumed alcohol. If I'm in the studio, sometimes I'll have, you know, like maybe, you know, I'll smoke weed, but like if I'm not really a weed smoker, but sometimes in the studio, it just makes me not think about anything else outside of the music.
And, you have a home studio, don't you?
Yeah, I have a home studio.
And is that where you've been doing most of it? How long have you had a studio at home that's actually like functional for what you're doing? Or do you just use it for demoing?
Yeah. So it's been for demos. I've had one functionally since 2018.
Oh, cool.
And it's really helped me. I mean, like even before COVID, I was well versed at recording myself, recording my own guitars. It's really helped me. I generally try not to depend on people, and of course you can't be an islander, but I try to learn about each part of, you know, the business or the craft so that I have at least a workable knowledge around it.
Are you quite have you become technical in the studio? Are you selective about your mic choice and your mic placements, or you just plug, or you just want to get the song into the system and an engineer will worry about that another time?
Yeah, I let the engineers worry about that. I've tried to, like, you know, go on Skillshare and look for courses and the like. But, you know, I mainly use my studio for songwriting purposes. And, you know, when you catch the vibe, you don't want to be thinking about the mic. You just want to get idea down. Yeah.
This studio that I'm in, me and my wife, who's also a song, we were songwriters for our career for many years. And what I love about it is we built this studio. It's actually really crap when someone else uses it, because everything is completely set up perfectly to have an
for
idea
you guys.
And to have it, you know, in the system and sounding okay within minutes. Like, I never have to worry about pushing anything or changing anything. You just walk in, press record, go, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. And I get annoyed because I do have a lot of people who come and say, oh, I just need to do something in your studio. But then they're in your studio, then everything's changed and you've got to go and figure out how to put it all back.
Yeah. No, a home studio definitely has to be plug and play.
Hmm. Brita, you are such a magnificent musician. I just what you're doing, how you're doing it, your voice is crazy. I'm sure you know that. Well, let's just start. We have to start at a mutual love for Oliver Mtukudzi, right?
Oh yeah,
I'm obsessed with him, and I was trying to get him on this podcast. I was trying to get him in at Amp Studios. We were trying to get all the pieces together. It didn't work out in time. Mm. Tell me about you growing up listening to Oliver.
Yes. So I'm originally from Zimbabwe. And growing up, Oliver Mtukudzi's music is like really the national anthem of Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
You know, there's this song when I was, I think, 10 years old that came out by Baba Oliver that was called Vuma, which means admit. Oh, I don't know if you know the song, Vuma Wasakara.
I know the song. Yes.
Which basically means it was like a sub code to then President Robert Mugabe, who had been in power for many, many years. And he had his, people that loved him and people that did not agree with his tactics. So a lot of Zimbabweans obviously felt frustrated by the fact that he's been in power for so long, although they continuously voted him in. So
supposedly,
there's this song. Yeah, supposedly, without getting much into the politics. So I remember when that song came out, everyone used to play that song until it got banned, obviously, because of the message. And
what are the lyrics? Tell me about what the lyrics are about.
So let me actually see if I can find it online. Let me. Vuma, Oliver Mtukudzi. So it's in Shona, and my Shona is not that good. Vuma iwe, so agree, admit. Vuma chete, like just admit, don't question. Vuma wasakara, admit to the fact that you're old. Vuma wa unyana, like you're out of flavor, you're out of taste.
Right, brilliant.
Vuma wasakara, like you're too old to be in power, basically. Yeah.
Wow, that's power.
Yeah,
amazing. I'll tell you just one side thing. I got when I was in a band, we got banned in Zimbabwe. We did a song about Zim, and it didn't go down well with Mugabe.
Yeah. Tell you what, I've been actually for 10 years now, I've been putting off doing my Zimbabwe album. Because I've always wanted, like my music is influenced by my surroundings where I've traveled to, and the Eastern Cape is a big part of it. Because when I first arrived in the Eastern Cape, I was, 20 years old. I came to study, that's where I met my friends. That's where I started jamming, going to jam sessions, learning how to write music. And I started writing a lot of music in Xhosa. But one of my dreams is to actually do an album for my home country. And I feel like when I do that album, I really need to be honest. I will not leave anything unsaid. So I've been putting that off for some time because I don't want to get banned.
So you don't have to answer this. Being from Zim, so I recognize, especially having this conversation as a total outsider, interpretation of what was going on in Zim. We wrote this like rebel song, which was, it was a boxing analogy, the people of Zimbabwe versus Robert Mugabe and his army. That was what our song was about. But from their family, grew up and obviously in touch with the sentiment of the time. What was the reality of what was good and what was bad?
So when I was younger, Zimbabwe was known as the breadbasket of Africa. So I think when you go to Zim, you understand. I don't know if you've been to Zimbabwe before.
I've never been there.
It's a beautiful country. It's a natural beauty. The weather, the climate, the people, just the landscape of the country. It's a beautiful country. it's a peaceful country. So growing up, my parents were, we were middle class. My parents were teachers. And they had set their lives up such that we were never going to leave Zimbabwe. They had bought, you know, their main home, which we lived in. They had like rental properties. They had a farming plot. My parents are farmers. And by the way, they now live in New Zealand where they work as dairy farmers. So,
is that sad or is that good? I mean,
well, you know, to explain it, growing up, my parents loved farming, but they were dedicated Zimbabweans. They were, you know, they were patriotic. They loved their country. And they had saved up money. They had saved up, they had been very resourceful to, you know, to the point that we were never meant to leave Zimbabwe. You know, contrary to the belief, if you notice, there's a lot of Zimbabwean immigrants all around the world. Even in South Africa, I think there's about 2 million of us here. But the thing is, what I think a lot of people don't know is that we didn't leave Zimbabwe by choice. I think the early 2000s, there was the, you know, and I'm not, you know, well informed about the politics of my country as I should be, because I left when I was very young. I was 16 years old when I moved with my parents to New Zealand. And also coming from a culture where you're not allowed to talk about politics, you're not allowed to talk about religion, you're not allowed to talk about anything sensitive, you're not allowed to talk about it. So I feel like, you know, I'd grown up in a society that was as perfect could be. And then in the early 2000s, you know, I think it was first the land uprisings, which I think were justified because, you know, African people need to own the land. I think that's what needs to be the case. And it's said that it's still not the case, even in South Africa to this day. But then after that, obviously sanctions were imposed on Zimbabwe. And then, the economy went downhill. Like, I remember one day where my dad, who was a teacher at the time, earned a salary. And I think by midday, the salary could only buy bread.
I remember that crazy time.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Mugabe story is sort of the classic story of someone who was a visionary, who had a good intention, but as always, these cases, like, so much power cannot help but corrupt people. And even if their intentions were still sound, there's just no way of fulfilling it. It's just, I mean, you see it happening in America, you know, and you're seeing it happen all over the world, that even if the ideology is the right ideology or the thinking, but once you're in a government structure, there's so many other things at play and you can't continue without being corrupted.
Yeah, I think the idea was great and still is. You know, one thing about Zimbabweans, like, my parents have 5 kids and they have at least 5 pieces of land. And my mother always says, you know what, you guys will never, you'll never fight about, you know, a place called home. You'll never fight about where to live. And then you come to South Africa and then you travel to, like, you know, the most beautiful part of the Western Cape. And then Ninini, there's like matchbox houses and you can't understand in this beautiful country with so much land, why are there, you know, people that live in matchbox homes? Why? You know, well, you go to Zimbabwe, there's none of that. So I think his ideas, you know, were great. I think it's just the implementation and also the level of greed. You know, because I think that also plays a part, you know, where there's power, there's also greed.
So that's what I'm saying. Do you think is greed and corruption the same thing? I mean, doesn't one lead to the other? And are you saying that there, when you say, okay, the thing I'm asking, I'm not trying to get into a political conversation. Yeah. I don't know. But was Mugabe corrupt at the end? Or are you just saying the institution was corrupt?
I think that there was both corruption and greed. Yeah. I think that they
exist. I don't know how we got here, by the way.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, just from an observation point of view, as a younger person, I think that greed and corruption, you know, coexist. They exist together. And I'm yet to, you know, really go into his story, really go into the story of my country to understand why and to understand how we can get out of that. As a young African girl, I am concerned about these issues. You know, I'm concerned about them because, one, I have a voice. I'm a musician, you know, and artists are supposed to reflect the times. But secondly, I do believe that better structures can be in place. And outside of music, my other passion is social entrepreneurship. And, you know, a lot of the times when I'm thinking about issues, you know, in the context of the world or the African continent, I'm always thinking about what solutions can we young people come up with, especially from a social entrepreneurship perspective where, you know, whatever the resources we put into the communities come back and plow more to the community.
I love that. And I'm also, that's very much, I was just smiling because you mentioned the term social entrepreneurship, and I didn't know that term until recently because I never realized what the work that I'm involved in, I never knew what to call it. So, So that's been very helpful. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to see is that, you know, I don't know you from a bar of soap, but from just the few minutes we've spent together, but really looking at the music and how you approach everything, you have a very unique quality, like such a soulfulness. And the thing that you that I love about you is that you actually care about the where you come from. So, you know, the fact that you're interested in going back to learn about the history of Zimbabwe and Mugabe, the fact that you still talk about Oliver Mtukudzi or Huma Sakela and you reference them, where I struggle with the fact that so many artists do not know or do not care anything about our actual history beyond, pre-TikTok. and our legacy artists are not relevant or regarded. And it's a very weird state that I find it in. So I love that you are sort of working in that space or that's part of your story and you make it part of your story. I think that's so important.
Nah, thank you. I think for me, when it came to like meeting Oliver Mtukudzi and meeting Brahim Masegela, it was merely luck. You know, when I think of how I met Brahim Masegela, I actually met him backstage of a festival in the Eastern Cape. And as you would know, like when it comes to festivals, that was like 7-8 years ago, I was still upcoming in the game. And normally what happens is that the young artists will play earlier in the day, and then the big guns will headline the festival. So in this case, the festival promoter had such terrible time management and stage management.
What a blessing.
Which is a blessing to me because I found myself having to headline for Brahim Masegela. So I ended up performing right after him because, you know, especially with him as well, like the older acts, they also need to perform by a certain time. Like if he doesn't perform by 10 p.m., then...
Well, he was still a rock star to the last day, right, though?
No, he was still a rock star. So I found myself performing right after him, right? And then he ends up watching my show, which he wouldn't have never done if I had performed at my, 4 p.m. time slot. So he watches my show, then comes up to me and is like, I really love, I loved watching you. You you're authentic. There's a simplicity to your sound and who you are that just radiates when you're on stage. And, you know, from there, we pick up a conversation. It's like, where are you from? I'm like, oh, I'm from Zimbabwe. He's like, oh, I'm going to see my friend Oliver Mtukudzi in like 2 weeks. I'm like,
oh my God.
I'm also going to see him. You know, like he was having, I think, like a 60th birthday and he had invited me and invited him as well. So we end up meeting 2 weeks prior to our invitation.
So hold on a second. Did you go to the birthday party?
Yeah.
Okay, now you have to tell me everything that happened at the birthday party. I want to know.
I can't tell you everything yet. So I end up.
Give me something here. I'm dying.
I end up at the birthday party. And, it's at, what's it called? The hotel, the Hilton Hotel in Harare.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And what Oliver Mtukudzi has done is he's invited all his friends. So all the, you know, older artists from different countries. Like, I think Judith Sapuma was there as well. Wow. Eric Wainaina from Kenya. You know, a couple other names were there. I found myself as the only, like, you know, like 20-year-old. At the time, I was like 22, 23 years old.
Were you supposed to be in Zim, or did you go for the birthday party?
I went for the birthday party.
that's the right answer. I would have done the same.
So Oliver Mtukudzi had recently discovered my music. I put out Thando Lwethu. And bear in mind, at the time, I was still a university student. No PR, no promotions, no marketing. Just the song that went out to radio. And, you know, just over a period of time, people fell in love with the song. And when he heard it and heard that I was from Zimbabwe, then he was interested in inviting me. So from there, I was able to just mingle with, you know, Brahim Masekela and Oliver Mtukudzi and just get to know them, you know, just as I had like a father-daughter relationship with both of them. And the funny thing is they were like complete opposites. Eh? Brahim Masekela is like a rock star, gangster. He'll tell you all the stories. You know, he even told me stories about him and Miriam Makeba.
Oof.
Oof. That's like, you know, Oliver Mtukudzi, on the other hand, he's like, you know, he's like granddad, quiet, reserved, you know. But, you know, I learned a lot from being around them. And I actually have a music video to the song that I did with them. And I'm the only artist that has a song that features both of them. You know, like that a collaboration with both of them. Yeah.
Shame. And then they both, you lost them both very quickly and both close to each other. That was a very bad 2 years of passings we had.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was terrible. I mean, I remember seeing Brahim when he was not well and, he had lost weight, but like his spirit was still radiating. You know, that's something about Brahim Masekela. You know, even if you read his biography, Grazing
in the Grass.
Oh my goodness. You know, he was so candid and open about who he was. Yeah. And then when it came to Oliver Mtukudzi, I'm fortunate to have, you know, toured around Southern Africa with him at least like 6 months before he passed. And wow. That's the time where like I'd gone independent and, you know, I took the year off to tour Eastern and, you know, East Africa and Southern Africa. And I took the initiative to actually trail, you know, go on the road with him, you know, book shows that he had booked so that I could spend, you know, time with him. And in South Africa, some promoters were booking me to, you know, like play in area with him and stuff like that. So just looking back.
You had great mentors.
Yeah. Yeah, just looking back, I'm filled with gratitude for having, you know, spent the time with both of them.
That is truly unbelievable. And you lucky. I got invited to Kaifa Semenya's 80th birthday.
Oh, I saw your tick. Was it like a TikTok the other day?
Yeah, I did one. And it was wild because I was there and the weird thing about it was like, I got there, I was totally by myself, you know, and I had a very weird experience. I know this is your interview, but I'm going to tell you anyway. this is a mad story. I got there early and I sat down at the theater. You know, I just got there, sat down, and this guy came up to me, and I'll tell you, the story is weird because I didn't know who it was. And it turned out to be, I can't remember his name. He's the last surviving member of the Manhattans.
Oh, right? Wow.
Now, he came up to me and gave me a huge hug and said, I can't believe you're here. I'm so excited to see you. And I was like, I do not know who you think I am, but I'm not that person. So he said to me, I've got this big picture of you and me on my wall at home, and I'd like to gift it to you. And hold on a second. And he went to get his wife, and he said, look who's here. And then they're sitting next to me, and they're like saying, and they're asking me, how is Barbara? They say, I was like, I don't know who the fuck Barbara is. So I say, Barbara, she couldn't make it, you know? Yeah, well, I don't know. I didn't know what to do.
John.
I didn't know. I was stuck. But they'd been talking at me for like 10 minutes. I hadn't said a word. They'd given me a hug and started ticking. I hadn't said it. So by the time they were asking me about Barbara, I was deep in it. But I felt very uncomfortable. So what I said was very, very, very rude. I know. I said, I've got to go to the toilet. And then I ran away. And I waited for the auditorium to be totally packed before I came in, because I didn't want to be seated next to them again and get stuck. So I waited till all the seats were taken. And then I walked in, and then Kaifa saw me, and he said, the only seat available, he said, I think it was for like Julius Malema was supposed to sit there. He said, no, but he sits somewhere else. So this seat's open. So I ended up sitting next to Kaifas, right?
Oh, wow.
But then the dude from the Manhattans, who was at the front row, turned around and saw me sitting next to Kaifas and was like, oh, of course, I must be that guy because I'm sitting next to the birthday boy. It was really wild. But the concert was one of the most amazing things I've ever. I felt like I was at a James Brown Motown concert. It was unbelievable.
Amazing.
Sorry, that was my story. I've never told that story, so you took me there. Burita, you know what? The other thing that I'm really interested in about you is how smart you are when it comes to the business side of stuff, and that you, you know, that you are now, and well, you have been for a while, you're independent. Tell me a little bit about, and also I want to move into your, you know, you are sort of music industry royalty now, the two of you, like these two dynamic powerhouse married to each other, married to the, to a troublemaker like myself, Nota.
okay.
Tell me a little bit about your take on the music industry and your approach to it, because I think a lot of people have a lot to learn from, I think, how you approach your business.
Yeah. So I started my career in 2012, right? And back then, I came to Joburg once, you know, like with my guitar, and went to, I know this might be unrelated to the story, but it's going to relate.
Where were you coming? You were coming from Zim, or were you living somewhere else?
So I moved to South Africa to study. I went to the Eastern Cape at Walter Sisulu University.
Right.
So I arrived there with my guitar and started playing community events, writing songs, you know, doing, you know, at the time I was like in varsity. So just having, you know, fun outside of school with music. And I had thought that my career was only going to start after I graduate from school. So I was still just honing my craft and like just developing my audience and my style and my sound. But when I first came to Joburg, my uncle who had come to visit introduced me to someone from a radio station. And, you know, that's how I got my first interview at Alex FM here in Joburg. And from there, people started calling, asking, when is your music coming out? Oh, we love your voice. We love your music. And this was like all new to me, because all along I'd just been just having a good time, you know, with music outside of school. And then I ended up being introduced to a record label at the time called Tummy Music. And that's how I signed my first record deal. I never had a lawyer look at it. I thought like this, you know, this is might be the only opportunity for me to record music at the time, you know. So I made a mistake that I was to pay school fees for like 5 years. For a very long time, I've been paying school fees for that mistake.
Are you still paying for it?
Thankfully, no. I actually bought my master's back now. That was the final school fees paying off
that
deal.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So I came to Joburg, recorded my album, went back to school, you know, and my real name is Guguletu, and Burita is actually my mother's name. So when my like the first copies of my album were ready, like the master, the record label asked me, what stage name are you going to use? And then I was like, oh, I'll use my mother's name, because Gugu is a very popular Zulu Xhosa name. So I didn't want, you know, I thought it was too popular and just too ordinary to be like a stage name. So when I first got like the first copies of my CD, I was shy. I was nervous and naive. I didn't know anything about the music industry. Here I had signed a contract, recorded, and now I had like a physical copy and I didn't know what to do. So I went back to school And the radio, the label sampled Thando Lwethu, which is like my breakout single. And once they sampled it, it started gaining traction on Metro FM. Eddie Zondi at the time used to play it every Sunday. So from there, you know, people were asking, who's this young lady? There's this song, this soulful Afro song, and we don't know who sings it, you know, to the point that I got a direct call from Musica at the time to bring my CDs in, which I now understand, you know, it's like really rare. Like how does head office Musica just call me out of the blues?
And more importantly, why is your record label not doing their damn job?
There we go. So I think once I got the call from Musica and I had to direct them to my record label, that's when I knew that something is wrong here. Like something is really wrong here because, you know, I didn't know anything about promotions or marketing, but I'm like, something should be happening and it's not happening. So I ended up, you know, like looking for like a manager and still based in the Eastern Cape. So I found, you know, one guy that had been in Joburg and had done road management. Tagged, you know, got him into my team, started actively promoting around campus. And back then, as soon as I started to have success, I think that summer, the CD sold about 5,000 copies. As soon as I started having like just a little bit of buzz, I started fighting with my record label because I had signed a 360 contract without my understanding. So I'd signed, there was just one line there that says that I will be managed, you know? So like okay, so the moment gigs, I know. So the moment gigs started coming in, they wanted to claim a management fee on that.
They wanted to recoup, yeah.
Thankfully, there was nothing to do with recoupment in that particular contract. But that's when I was like, but hang on a moment. At the time, I didn't understand. I didn't know anything about the recording industry or the music industry. But I was like, but why do you want to get paid off the work that you're not doing? You're not marketing my album, you know? And then from there, it became a real fight. And, you know, and by now, the song is blowing up. Oskido has remixed my song and put it in his album. Now it's really blowing up. Now, you know, people think I'm signed to Galawa Jazmi. So now the record label is angry because they think that Galawa Jazmi is trying to steal their artist. So now there's like an entire fight going on. And I think I went to go see one business affairs person that I was at the time recommended to sit with. And he looked at me and said, young lady, you need to go.
Who is this person? Who is the person?
I don't want to say his name.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I like to know, but I get you.
I'll tell you off the record though.
Okay.
Yeah. So he says to me, he looks at me and says, young lady, it's clear you feel entitled. You don't know anything about the music industry, but you think everything must be going your way. You need to go find a book called The South African Music Industry by Jonathan Shaw. That's all he said to me. I was like, you know. Went and got the book. The first thing I did when I got that book is went to the management part of it, read about it, and then I went to my road manager/manager and said, listen, we're not going to share 50-50. It doesn't work like this. So you...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can I just check something? The 360 deal you were on, what was the record label wanting to take from your management fees? 50%?
So... The initial 360, the record label wanted to take 20%, which is like 20% is a management fee. Then my new road manager/manager wanted to share equally, and he wasn't bringing any equity into it.
Jeez, this is like a real lesson from hell.
Yeah, I paid my school fees and I was yet to pay because with that book, I was able to go back to my manager. I actually drafted our management agreement based on that Jonathan Shaw book. And from there, at least I was able to correct within, you know, my smaller structure to say, listen, from a management point of view, I'm going to open a company and this is how it's going to work. You know, you're going to take a 20% and I'm going to compensate you for XYZ costs, you know, when we're traveling or, you know, just normal, ordinary costs. And I'm going to open a bank account and, you know, all the money is going to come into the business account and, you know, you're going to have access to view what's happening, but I have the, I will control the bank account.
I'm going
to
pay you. That's what.
And I'm going to pay you. Yes.
Yeah.
So from there, luckily, I was able to sort that. But for I think 2013, 2014, 2015, I was like in a legal fight with my record label.
That's exhausting.
And at the time, I was a student. I was like a varsity student. So I remember going from writing exams to like talking to lawyers to paying hectic legal fees at the time, you know, and not really getting anywhere as well because I had signed the contract, you know, and, you know, as you know, and at the time as well, at the time I had interest from, you know, major record labels, but they needed to see a clearance. And without a clearance, and that's the thing that young people don't get about now being in the digital era, where you can actually just go out there and put out your music, you know, using a DIY service. Back then, there was none of that. And then by the time I had gotten out of it took me about 2-3 years to get out of the deal with my label. And by the time to get out of it, I had to like literally not have lawyers involved, go down and sit with him and say, listen, you know, what do you want? And at the time, I think we ended up agreeing. I still had a lot of school fees to pay. I ended up, letting him publish my second album for like 5 years or something like that. But then at least, you know, I was able to get a clearance to say you're out of this deal. And by then I put out a second album, which hadn't done as well as the first one. The music was great. I mean, the second album had like the song with Baba Oliver Mtukudzi and Pahuma Segela.
Yeah.
And, you know, the record label had produced the second album, but it just didn't resonate with, you know, like just pop top 40 radio the way like Thando Lwethu had. And because I hadn't had that kind of success and I hadn't really had a strong management team as well, you know, I wasn't really getting the bookings as well. So that's when I knew
your energy was into trying to untangle the mess you'd made as opposed to taking your career forward.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. So I had to think. I moved to Joburg. I'd finished studying. I'd graduated cum laude with a diploma in financial information systems. Through all of this, so I was like, okay, at least I've got something, you know, to show for it. And I had won like best African pop album at the Metros. Thando Lwethu is like, you know, it's a classic Afro soul song. So to this day, it's still like one of my biggest songs. But I now had like a Surfomo's curse because my second album hadn't done well. And I had to ask myself serious questions. And when you're an artist, you know, you're very insecure. And to the point that when things are not going well, you think it's the music. You know, you think maybe I'm not good enough. You know, and that messes with you, John, because then you go into a writer's block. You know, the one thing that you really loved, that you were holding on to, then you can't do anymore. And not only are you in a writer's block, bills need to be paid.
Also, when you get in the writer's block cycle, just thinking that you're in a writer's block makes it worse. Like the panic that you get from thinking you're doing it, just makes it no way. It's like trying very hard to go to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
The harder you try, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. So I fortunately, you know, met Benza from Fifth Season at that time as well. And Benza, I was very open and honest with Benza with, you know, the success I had had and, you know, the school fees I was paying and all that stuff. And, you know, he took me under his wing. He signed me to another artist agreement and another management contract. And, you know, I'll be honest to say what I was able to gain from working with Fifth Season over a period of 2 years is the understanding of how the business actually works.
They are business savvy, that team.
Yeah. So I was able to actually, you know, Benza was the first person to break it to me to say, young lady, you've just had a Sophomore's curse and you need to come back with a really strong album. I believe in you. And like, I'll always be grateful to Benza for that. As well, you know, before long as well, I was quickly able to see that the Fifth Season structure was not the structure for an artist like me. You know, they had had their hits and misses, you know, and that's the thing about this industry is that when you're successful, you're really successful. And when you tank, you really tank, you yes. know? So at the time, I think they were really focused on AKA's career. And, you know, this was like at the height of, you know, the Levels album. So I was able to watch all of this and I put out my own album at the time, which, you know, didn't do as bad as my second album, but it was still not, you know, like the way my debut album had performed, you know, in the commercial space. Cause then my album, debut album had gone gold and is now platinum. So I think after working with like Benza for like 2 years, I was able to come to terms with the fact that I didn't think their deal structure worked for me. I didn't think that at the time, you know, like, how do I put this, John? I just decided to take all responsibility to myself. Mm. I hated the fact that my third album hadn't met the expectation I had. And I couldn't blame myself for it. I could say that, you know, there was a lot of a feeling of, I don't feel like, you know, my partners did what they were supposed to do. So I was like, what would it be like to actually take that responsibility off people and just put it towards myself? What would that be like? What's, you know, what's the risk in that? And what's the reward in that? And, you know, what are the challenges in that? So the risk in that was that I'd never seen a female artist in South Africa go independent and do better than they had done with a label before, especially in the Afropop, Afrosoul space.
Game on.
You know, game on indeed. I'd seen artists that, you know, still hold on to the success from a recording industry perspective, that they still are able to benefit from the success that they had with, you know, the previous label, which is, you know, great. But I thought there was a missing link there. So it meant that I needed to educate myself about the industry, you know. The other thing is that I realized that as well, like, I started my career in the last bout of physical sales. So because of that, I just started to realize that music, you know, the industry, the business is always moving with the technology. So some people are going to be left behind. Some people are going to win. You know, some people are going to be Lil Nas X, mainly because you just came out with a song and, it, you know, technology was moving towards TikTok and you were able to monetize and you were able to advertise within that 15-second space.
I mean, I think the thing that's interesting is what the major labels are doing really well is using the tech, like, and not telling anyone how it works. So if you can figure that stuff out, you can, you know, you can do everything that a label
it's,
can do.
Definitely. It's a lot of hard work. It's a mind fuck for an artist because you're used to just, you know, just being in the studio and just writing. But I really had to start to think of myself as any business owner, you know, even if I were like a fashion designer or like a chef, you know, that had my own restaurant or a doctor that had like a practice, I would have to be competent in my craft and I'd also need to be competent in the business. And I would need to surround myself with a team that works for me, you know, and that reports directly to me. You know, I would need to be able to know why, you know, I'd need to be able to set key performance indicators and be
Look
able
at
to
you.
See what's
Talk
working.
More business to me.
You know, what's working and, you know, what's not working, you know. So that's really the route that I took over the past 3 years. And it worked out. I put out my fourth album, you know, and like, you know, I've had, like, last year I spent like 4 weeks at number one on radio. You know, I had like three actually really successful singles. And for me, the measurement is with my fans. Like, I can see the engagement with my fans. They know my music. You know, in the Benza era where I had a great album, my fans were asking me, what's happening? When is your album coming out? You know what I mean? And in the previous era with my second album, my fans were asking, why is your album not in stores?
Right.
You know, with my first album, Musica was calling me and asking me, why don't we have your album? So with my fourth album, I was able to take full responsibility you know, I was able to like grow my streaming numbers. I'm still working towards that. I'm still not where I would like to be. But what makes me sleep at night is that I'm fully responsible for my career. And I'm fully responsible for the energy that I bring towards it, whether it's in the business or in the art. And I own, you know, I'm in a position now where I own 80% of my catalog. I was able to buy back my initial albums, and now I own all the new stuff.
That is a great story, Barida. I mean, that is really an inspiring story. So let me ask you about that. What is the... I mean, why are more artists not able to do that? I mean, you know, obviously all your bad experiences put you in a position where you actually knew a lot of how to do things badly, or yeah. what or where the holes in the system were. To build a system yourself is a hell of a thing. To build a team is a hell of a thing. What are those things that you think up-and-coming artists don't know that you could share with them that would help them get into a stronger position?
I think digital made things much easier, hey? And I think that a lot of South African... I get a lot of correspondence from upcoming artists, especially female, because that's where I devote my energy. So I actually have just started an NGO now called The Womb, The Woman of the Music Business, because I was constantly...
The Womb.
The Womb.
What did you call it? The Woman
of, yes, The Womb. The Woman of Music Business.
Amazing. Tell me about this.
So I've been getting a lot of women, well, just artists in general. Sometimes I get asked questions by upcoming artists, sometimes artists that are in my tier, sometimes artists that are perhaps more advanced than me. I find myself being a resource for a lot of people, which, you know, for me, I had to think very carefully about, because I'm trying very much to be an intentional person. So when I was intentional to myself, I realized that I really enjoy, I enjoy sharing knowledge. I enjoy leading, especially even within my own team, within my own business. I enjoy watching people grow. So I then last year, started The Womb, The Woman of the Music Business, as a way for me to support upcoming and not just artists, but like just women in the creatives. So we're currently in the process of building different programs that support women, whether it's like artists, engineers, producers, you know, heck, we don't have enough executives in the music industry and that are female, sorry. So I'm thinking a lot about that gender disparity within the music industry and asking myself how I can provide a solution, you know, without, because I also am still trying to figure out my business structure. So I'm not in a position to like sign or develop talent, but I am in a position to have this social enterprise venture to fill, you know, just to fill my need to share that information.
That is amazing. And two things. Firstly, if you ever need to use Amped to host your thing there, you consider that space yours. I mean, that's what we want to do there.
Yeah.
So have workshops there, use anything you want there. That would be amazing. Do you know about, I don't know that it's exactly related, but it might be worth it. How do you know Yvonne Chaka Chaka?
Oh, yes, I do. She is like, she's my mentor. She's my mom. She's my friend.
So you know about her women radio station that she's doing to unite women from around the world?
Yes, I've been there.
Oh, okay, you've been there. All right, so you know all about it there. I just thought maybe there was a connection between what you're doing and what she's doing, but there obviously is.
Yeah.
And then I think I've seen you on Clubhouse around as well. Are you how you, I mean, that app's unbelievable.
Yeah, I love Clubhouse. I love connecting with people authentically. And I think for the longest time, I'm quiet, I'm shy. So I think sometimes it's been to my disadvantage, because then I would have information to contribute, but I would not come forth, you know. But recently, when I sit in spaces, I get invited again, you know, to speak in them or to delegate or to be a part of the conversation, especially because I really have passion. I love music, period. Mm. Outside of like the business, you know, I genuinely love music, and I see myself like making music, you know, like I don't see myself retiring from music. I once thought I was going to retire because of the business and how much it gets into your head.
Yeah.
You know,
it's enough
but now
to turn anybody off.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I find it fascinating to really grow, you know, to allow myself to use all my talents, to use, you know, the talent that really brings me here to sing and to write songs and be on stage. But also I'm turning 30 this year. You know, I don't want to be one of those artists that are still trying to be a pop artist and your time is up.
Right.
So I want to make sure that I continue enjoying what I do, but I also fuel a younger generation of particularly female creatives, artists.
This is what I was going to say. Don't you see in Clubhouse, I mean, it hasn't adopted here yet, and partially because it's still on iPhone only.
Yeah.
To me, Clubhouse offers a solution to a massive problem in South Africa, and that is access to information and access to resources from home. And for you to do something like your Womb project through Clubhouse, especially when they launch it into Android, I see Clubhouse transforming Africa if we can
Absolutely.
Just get people into and just to understand the power of it.
Yeah, I share the same sentiments. I've obviously been taking one step at a time with the Womb, but the next step is definitely to set up a room so that I can engage women from all across the continent, because we are continental. We've run one program before last year, which is a Pan-African program that impacted 30 women. We're just about to run another one. I'll add you to my newsletter because I see that there's a lot of things I need to chat to you about.
There's a lot of stuff I've been making notes that when we finish, I want to text you about, or we can talk about another time.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, have I lost? We don't have a lot of time. I just want to. I saw how you gave me a funny look when I brought this up, but I want to understand because I know Nota for years.
Yeah.
How did you meet? and I mean, yeah, I can understand. This is a weird question. I'm asking you this question because I wonder what someone would ask my wife, being married to someone who throws firebombs into situations on a daily basis.
Yeah.
That's me. So I wanted to get your take on it from the inside, from the other side.
Yeah. My story of meeting Nota is funny because before we met, we met a couple of times. And he reminds me that I saw you at this place and I saw you at this place. And I'm like, really? You know? But we really connected. After having met a couple of times, we connected end of 2018. And I think we first met, obviously, because at the time I was, you know, like there's some business stuff that I, you know, was sitting down with him up on. And then from there, we just developed a friendship very quickly and became lovers very quickly, I guess. And I think what excites me about Nota, outside of, you know, like obviously the music industry, because I'm not one that believes in like power couples or like, you know, I just believe in like just meeting people and having those connections. And I think when it comes to Nota, just on a personal basis, we connected on so many levels. We also love music as well, you know, both of us. And, you know, he's also more into the, obviously the business side of things in terms of the music. And I think what we...
But so are you. I mean, this is where the dynamic is really interesting. You've wrestled control of your career. You're the boss of your empire.
I'm
interested to imagine how the discussions and arguments are around maybe a particular strategy or a decision might be.
Absolutely. I mean, we discuss a lot of things. And sometimes we, you know, like if you were to go through our iMessages or like WhatsApp, sometimes we're just sending each other like music business worldwide articles.
Right.
That's what it is. And like a heart. You know, we're always just watching, just like, oh, so did you see this thing? So what you think of this? Oh, okay. You know, we engaged each other like that, you know, in terms of like the business of music. But I think more than anything, we are a support structure for each other. Mm. He does support me a lot. He likes to pull away though, because I am also quite an independent and strong woman, and he doesn't like people thinking that, because a lot of people would think that like he manages me or he's involved in my stuff, which he's not. And he likes to pull away for that purpose. You
so
know?
He knows where the line is and he knows where to make space or yeah, to leave space.
Yeah, he actually mostly makes space, to be quite honest. He's hardly... Yeah, he for him, a lot of people will see things and be like, yo, you know, your wife or whatever. And he'll be like, I don't even know about that. You know, like,
right.
I just know that my wife is busy. I just see my wife just being busy.
That's cool.
And actually, I think I'm busier than him. You know, I'm like, there's times where he wants to chat and I'm like, I'm actually, you know, quite busy.
That's an incredible quality. I can't help but interfere with my wife's business. I can't help it.
Yeah, but I also like I enjoy supporting him, you know, because like you say, he's someone who's he's a fireball, you know, and you know I'm the person that's up in the morning doing yoga, doing meditation. He's up in the morning and already like
dropping
he knows
Twitter
what,
bombs.
You know, to the point that you know, like people will ask me sometimes. People will like tag me online, and I'm like, guys, only if you knew, like, I just had like a 20-minute meditation session right now. Like, I couldn't care less what's like trending on Twitter.
Oh,
yeah,
amazing.
So it's that crazy dynamic, but yeah,
incredible. Okay, last question, and then I will let you go. I actually feel like I haven't even started the conversation I wanted to have with you that I would love, wait, maybe in a few months, or maybe informally, we'll just have to continue this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm loving chatting to you, really. Yeah. I think you're really incredible at everything you're doing. What I wanted to say is, how in a short version, how has your lockdown been, and where are you with a new project?
Yes. So lockdown, oh my goodness. For me, I think lockdown really gave me time to reflect, you know, to really reflect on myself and take care of myself. I think I spent the last 9 years really trying to, you know, just fight in terms of like my career. And I'll tell you, John, like, I feel like, you know, like the artist career is a very selfish career. It's very demanding on you as a human being. It's demanding on your mental health, you know? So I think for me, the COVID, the lockdown period really helped me to, you know, find my center. And that's what I'm continuously working on at the moment.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so, and musically?
And musically, I'm done with my upcoming EP. I've been done for a while now. So I'm excited because, I mean, I was able to work on two projects last year. The one that, you know, that came out, the album.
Yes.
Songs in the Key of Love.
Yes. And then after that was the duet you did with the Ndlovu guys, right?
Yes, yes. Then I closed the year with the duet with Ndlovu Youth Choir, which was just a phenomenal experience. And then I also worked on an EP, which is upcoming, called Dance, Praise and Worship. It taps more into the spiritual. I would say it's a cross between like Afro soul dance music and really just the spiritual undertone, which I gained during the lockdown, which I feel like, you know, we all need right now.
Mm. Amazing. And then lastly, if you do a Zimbabwe album,
yeah,
would it be an album of... covers maybe, or would it be an album of you just expressing yourself through the music?
Yeah. I think that it would definitely be expressing myself through music. I would tackle the themes, you know, that, you know, have put Zimbabwe on the map in the past 20-30 years. And also I would reflect on how those things affect the rest of Africa, especially South Africa. I want to kind of like intersect Zimbabwe and South Africa within the African context, as someone that is Zimbabwean, and I've seen that some of the challenges that we face here in South Africa, you know, with the political system and some of the challenges, like, you know, the fees must fall movements, you know, I can see certain things, certain roots and seeds that come from Zimbabwe that are infiltrating into South Africa. And I can see how that affects the rest of the continent.
Mm. Amazing. And it is something weird that we don't do more inter-country work in this. I mean, South Africa seems to be an island. We treat it like an island. But while the rest of the continent know that they exist, we don't seem to here. So I love that you're bridging a gap there.
I would go as far as to say, I remember when I was in East Africa, someone said, you know, South Africans, they think they're South Africa and the rest of Africa. South Africans don't think they're in Africa.
It's weird. And it's a very weird phenomenon, and it's time to do away with it. I'm very much a supporter of closing the borders there.
Yeah.
When I say definitely. Closing the borders, I mean doing away with them, not closing them.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, that intersection. But I think we see it a bit in music. We see it a lot, especially, you know, there's a love-hate relationship between Nigeria and South Africa. Yes. You know, one minute it's Afro beats, one minute it's Amapiano, the next it's like Afro piano.
Nigeria wins now. Nigeria's won the war now. They've taken off. And we're not the center of the universe anymore. We've got to catch up. And maybe that's the incentive for us to be a bit more open about these sorts of things.
Yeah. But I think overall, I'm grateful, man. I'm grateful for South Africa. I wouldn't be who I am today if we're not for, you know, the welcoming arms of South Africans.
Last question. Sorry, I've said that six times already. Was it difficult to come to South Africa?
You know what, hey? Traditionally and historically, my people are from KwaZulu Natal. My surname is Khumalo. So in terms of like the history, without going into it deep, tribally, I'm South African. So even the language that I speak, Ndebele, is like a Nguni language, which is a language that sits in between Zulu and Xhosa. So because of that, for me coming to South Africa, interestingly, felt like coming home. And more so when I go to Durban, I even find that even when I'm like doing shows in Durban or promoting, there's just this energy that exists. And I think it's because my ancestors and my people are South African.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Barita, I'm such a fan of you, definitely as an artist, but more importantly as a person. I really appreciate you coming on What's Your Poison, even though you don't drink, and I didn't hold it against you. And I appreciate you very much, and I hope we can catch up and talk more. Really, I do.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John. I enjoyed myself.
Good luck, and go and dominate, woman.
Thank you. All right,
cool.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of What's Your Poison. Go to johnsavage.com/ What's Your Poison to subscribe to our newsletter, find out more exclusive things, get access to merch and innovation stuff. Also, I don't know why I said innovation, I meant information, but it came out innovation. I like that word. If you're on Apple, just hit the 5-star rating. Why not? It won't hurt you and it will make me feel nice. If you're on the Spotify, recommend it. Share. Sharing is good. Sharing is caring. Oh, I can't believe I said that. No, I'm annoyed now. I'm just going to finish.